It's Wednesday, August 11th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 201 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
And this is Johan.
And my name is Chris.
You know what? Johan has given us a new name for him since his proper name of mother has to get bleeped out. He pointed something out that I hadn't noticed. Johan comes and fills in once per month when Chad is out at his board gaming group.
Yes.
Johan is our monthly visitor. As he described himself, he is our Uncle Flo.
I call him Red for short.
Nice.
And he is a mother to deal with.
That's true. But as an uncle, anyone can come sit on my lap.
I actually have a Wayne's awkward confession that goes with that, but I won't tell it because I wouldn't want to steal any of Wayne's thunder.
Go ahead, Chris. You've had your sandwich.
Yeah,
aboard.
I have no idea what you're going with here.
All right. Well, speaking of Uncle Flo and all that stuff, I have five older sisters. When I was very young, this story was related to me that I did this. Apparently, I went into the bathroom and dug through the garbage, found two wrapped napkins, I guess you would say, two wrap pads, and I came out, held them up in front of my mother and my sisters, and I said, "Look, the number 11.
Wow.
I don't know why I love that. I just do.
And it was all downhill from there.
And everything went downhill from that point. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know how to respond to that.
I don't know how to recover from this one.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you later.
So, okay, Gen Con's over by the time this show drops. We're actually recording it on July 27th, but it's going to drop on August 11th.
And man, was that a good con. Pat, do you remember when you did that one thing with that one thing?
Oh my God, I tell you what, I'm surprised I'm still alive and not blind.
I can't believe what happened on that Wednesday through Sunday. So by this time, we should have put up quite a bit of coverage, video interviews, blog posts, pictures, all that kind of stuff on the feartheboot.com blog. So be sure to get out to the website and check that stuff out and see what we were up to, and we will leave our Gen Con conversation at that, unless actually during the real con something of such significance happens we feel we just have to cover it, but we will try to keep that to a minimum. So let's dive straight into it. There's a topic that Wayne suggested, because this is something that has come up in quite a few of our games. In fact, this is something that I have been dealing with as a game master going all the way back to the very first games I ran, just because I've always had players who are very proactive, rambunctious people. And the situation Wayne brought up is dealing with creative actions during combat, maybe during the game in general, but we'll focus on combat for the moment. What I'm talking about is you've got, let's say, a combat going on in a Deadlands game, and you've got a group of people fighting around a train station, and there's one of those big rewatering things for the train. And instead of just taking a gun and shooting the other guy, for which there are plenty of existent rules, he instead does something to try and chop a support out from under that water tower and dump it all over the bad guys and crush them under the falling apparatus and water.
Perfect thing for a huckster to do.
And so the question is, as a game master, how do you deal with that?
Besides enjoying the fact that your players want more roleplay in combat or things like that, because that's the only thing, I want this. I mean, I'd like to do a lot more GMing than I've done. I want to have players come up with really interesting things, but I'm actually kind of nervous about it. Like, if something like that happens, I don't have a mechanic for it. I don't want to figure out a mechanic for it. I want to be able to roll with it and go quickly. So that's what I'm kind of curious. What do you do in those situations where you're just caught off guard? You have no clue they were going to do this.
I think that that's absolutely the key that you already said there. You've got to sort of roll with it and go on the fly. There's not really a mechanic. I mean, in Dan's example there, I mean, if, say, you know, the huckster is able to, you know, wrangle one of the spirits or pull out a support and it dumps the water in or on the bad guys, he's going to have to say, oh, okay, well, the water tower crumbles and the guys, they look in fear as the deluge of water washes over them and it knocks them down, and they take a little bit of damage, but now they're all in their complete disarray. And so now you have the advantage of the situation.
What do you do if your player then looks at you and says, well, how much damage did they take?
Well, and that's exactly the boundary that I want to put on this topic, is we're not talking about ideas that are per se just creative. We're talking specifically about ideas that are not covered by the rules.
Right.
And so if the rules are there for it and it's creative, this is not an issue. You flip to page 108 and you go down to that section, hopefully because the book has an index. And if it doesn't, every publisher is listening, please put indexes in your book, for God's sake.
Amen. We even saw this in a homebrew. Your character, Dan, pulled some rocks up with telekinesis and smashed it into the back of someone. You telekinetically picked someone up and smashed them into a ceiling.
Yeah, because he was sitting in a stone chair and I could manipulate rocks. I said, well, he's sitting in a stone chair. I'll just smash the stone's chair into the ceiling and crush the guy between. Yeah,
which was an incredible idea. And the system we were playing again was a complete homebrew. And it's like, I have no idea how to do the math on this. I want him to roll something to see how high it impacts and if he actually kills him with one shot. But I don't know what to have him roll.
I think when you do these kinds of things, it's all various degrees of compromise. And that, you know, if your player has an ingenious idea like that, say the water tower, for example, you know, that might be something worthwhile to let him go ahead and go, unless it's a really story critical combat that's going on and you don't want it ended in one swell foop, like the whole thing with a chair. You know, you don't want that guy wiped out right away. Well, then you got to come up with some reason why that can't happen. And really, mechanic wise, you know, you got to tie it to something, obviously, so it happens. But there's no reason to try and get real detailed with it. I think by playing a little bit fast and loose with those rules, A, is in the spirit in which that idea was given, and it helps keep things flowing fast enough so you don't have to start digging through a book.
I agree. You really have to be a little bit cautious of playing too close to the rules when it comes to creative ideas. I know, especially in a rules-heavy game like D&D is a good example, you can find a rule for almost anything that your players want to do if you're willing to sit there and spend 20 minutes doing it, and you can use that to screw them out of their ideas.
You know, that actually is another aspect of this question that I've wondered about. I don't know all of these rule systems in and out. I mean, D&D is a good example. Even Savage Worlds, there's rules for all of these things that you're not going to be able to memorize every rule that's available. What do you do if you actually have that situation where, okay, that was really cool, here's what happened, and someone says, but that's not the mechanic for doing that?
Let me back up here and hit on a couple thoughts that were presented throughout all that. First of all, Chris, I'm going to back way up here, and your explanation, I agree with everything you said, except I take umbrage with one particular phrase, which is you said, unless it's a story critical combat. I'm not sure I can sign on to that one. In my mind, if the players did it, the players did it. The fact that I, as a game master, wanted a combat to go a certain way or didn't want a particular bad guy to get killed so easily, I would not use that to trump what the players rightfully created and rightfully executed.
If you'll remember, Chris, that's something that pissed me off in a recent bonus episode.
Yeah, you don't want to piss Matt off again.
Actually, I think we do. Everyone's talking about how wonderful it was to hear him talk.
That's true.
I think there's varying degrees, though, of that, because, I mean, it's...
I would tend to agree. There are definitely varying degrees of screwing the players out of something that they should have. And if you let it go too far, you're going to let the players screw themselves out of fun.
Yeah, exactly. If you come up with some creative way to wipe him out in one round, and this is the final dramatic showdown, I think that you're just doing a disservice to, you're almost in a certain way doing a disservice to the players, because what you said, Johan, you're screwing them out of that fun. And yeah, they may have a certain level of fun in the fact that, wow, we totally got around that and nailed that guy. But on the other side of that coin, they screwed themselves out of the fact of having a really, ultimately, more satisfying ending by going through the trial and tribulation of fighting that guy the more traditional way, or the way in which maybe it should have happened, or you thought it might happen.
Oh, Chad, you've won an early night.
Okay, maybe, but let me throw this in a different direction, then we'll move on, because this isn't really per se a topic we're on, so I don't want to tangent too long. But let me throw a counterpoint out there. What is the most memorable fight in Raiders of the Lost Ark? The one that everybody cites?
It's the pistol. Yeah, it's the
pistol shot. It's the guy who comes out, does this 10-15 second setup of him flipping swords around. Indy takes out his pistol and shoots him.
Okay, but wait, no, but if he did that to Belloc and then walked away with the Ark, what kind of movie would that have been? How would that have been a good movie?
Yeah, but I'd say it's poor game mastering if you put Belloc with no protection in the middle of his pistol sights in an empty street, is what I would say. But all right, I don't want to belabor this one too much, Chris. Maybe you and I will brawl on this in a later episode. But my point being that I think sometimes, and I'll just leave it at this, I think sometimes those unexpected quick endings can be just as cool and just as memorable as the epic 30-minute fight. And I'll just leave it at that. And like I said, Chris, we will brawl on this in a future episode. But moving on next to something Johan said, you mentioned D&D. I think D&D and perhaps Savage Worlds and some other games give you a cheap workaround in that a lot of times you can find rules that approximate what you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
So, for example, there may not be rules in, let's say this happened in D&D. I don't know why there's water towers or trains in D&D, but let's just go with it. And let's say that you knock it over in D&D. There may not be specifically rules for dropping a water filling station on somebody, but you can probably find there a spell are. For creating something. Yeah, I'm sure there's some splat book. There's the trains and trash cans handbook or well, something.
I mean, there's rules for breaking wood. There's rules for falling damage. There's rules for objects falling on you, and there's rules for flooding.
And so. I'm sure there's probably a spell that creates a wave of water and
absolutely.
And so you can grab rules that approximate it. Wayne, to your point about the rules lawyering, if somebody came along and said, you know what, on page 108, there are rules for handling that, as a game master, I would take that under consideration. Because, I mean, to me, that's not per se cross line into rules lawyering. They're not trying to be a dick. They're trying to help me figure it out. He tried to do this. Hey, there are rules, and by playing this game, I think we've at least generally agreed that we're going to abide by these rules. There are rules on this page for handling that. Maybe we should look that direction. And I would take that as useful insight. To me, that would not cross the line into him being a jerk.
Furthermore, I think that if you're a player that is doing this and it and has that information, then you should have that looked up and ready whenever you
absolutely.
Do that. You shouldn't let the DM make fumble the call and do it and then say, no, I'm sorry, but on page 108, it's actually done this way. You come up with that in the first place. Say, okay, I knocked the water tower over. Cool, it succeeded. Okay, here on page 108, this is like, you know, rules for whatever, water, flooding damage, whatever.
I would even take a step back from that. And just from my own experience with dealing stuff like with things of this nature, I would, from a player's standpoint, come at the DM as I'm saying, this is what I would like to do, and these are the rules that I think should apply. Are these rules going to apply before I say
that's
I
a good
do
point.
This?
No, that is true.
That is a good point.
On both sides of the table, I have been in that situation, and what the DM decided to do was not at all what the player was expecting, and then there's hurt feelings.
You know,
I had this brilliant idea, and you screwed me out of it because you didn't use the right rules, you...
Along those lines, one of my frustrations is when you come up with something really cool and then there is a rule for it and that rule makes whatever you are trying to do just
worthless.
Fall apart. I mean, I'm sure there are wonderful rules and wonderful systems I haven't experienced. I have never seen a grappling rule that I like in any game. Everyone has cheated me out of something cool I wanted to do.
Yes, they all do. Yeah. We'll just proceed.
I think where we started this is probably the point that I would make my central thesis of handling this, which is keep the game moving. Fast and fair is better than perfectly rules accurate.
Yeah.
Johan, I think you made an excellent point about when somebody goes up to do something. First off, if rules exist to do it, I think it's actually Pat, you said this part, they should probably have these queued up ahead of time.
Yeah.
And then as Johan said, it may also be helpful if the player communicates to the GM, I am trying to do this to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. I am trying to knock this thing over to wash them away in the deluge of water. And so the GM knows where you're going with this and will at least give you a fair shake at doing it, presuming it's a fair and reasonable GM. But at the end of the day, I would sooner have the GM say, you know what? We're just going to shoot some real quick attribute saves. And if they make it, nothing happens. If they botch it, this is what happens. If they really botch it, this is something even worse that happens. And just go with it, because I would rather do that, even if it's not perfectly accurate to the rules personally. And I'm sure it's different in every group. But in my group, I'd rather just do it and move forward than spend the next 30 minutes consulting forums and splat books and whatever and
absolutely
trying to figure out exactly what the precise rules for something is.
Nothing kills a dramatic combat faster than sitting there and poring over the rules. And I mean, regardless of whether you're trying to do something clever or not, I mean, it's bad for the GM and it's bad for the players. You know, combats are meant to be exciting, moving entities and to sit there and slog through crap that you really shouldn't. It's not worth it.
Yeah, I've killed more dramatic moments than I can count, both as a player and DM, with exactly that mentality. My biggest fault as both a player and DM is that I am very tactical, I'm very rules-oriented, and I want things to work the way they're supposed to work. And I let that get ahead of me and run off with the game from time to time. And I think that's something that especially DMs need to watch out for. I know I've ruined quite a few sessions by doing that.
I sort of struggle with that too, and I've been noticing it lately. especially when I'm playing a magic user, because what I find, especially in a D&D setting, is you go from round to round, you have your action, and then it's going to be a while before you come up, you know, it's your turn again. I mean, it could be as much as 5 to maybe 20 minutes before it's your turn or whatever. And that entire time I'm watching what's going on, and I'm trying to think, okay, what spell am I going to use now? And I get an idea, but then when the other four people around the table, by the time they get going, they do something, and the bad guys get to go, and all of a sudden it gets to be my turn. All of a sudden something has just happened that completely destroys the idea that I had. And like, I can't do that anymore. And now I'm scrambling to figure out what the hell am I going to do now? And I hate it, because when this happened the other night, I'm sitting there, it's my turn. I won initiative. It's Pat's turn to go first. I'm like, shit, what am I going to do now? And I'm sitting there pouring through my spell list going, what's the most effective thing? Or in this sense, what can I do to save some people? Because people are about to die. Yeah. And I'm starting to think, what's the best thing I can do? And it's...
Well, the consequence, though, and this goes right back to what we started talking about here. The consequence of playing in character is that your in-character action may be something significantly more complicated than swinging a sword.
Yeah.
Or it may be something that, in order to work in a way you want it to, requires a result that the rules are not structured to allow. There is no rule system anywhere, period, ever, that accounts for everything. The only ones that claim to are those that, in truth, account for nothing. You know, they just hand wave everything and say, oh, just roll a d20 against anything, to the point that really they're actually covering nothing. But any rule system is going to have an action someone doesn't have rules to cover. Mm-hmm. For example, let's take a real simple one. You try to hit a dude with a chair. Well, in most role-playing games, what are you going to do to try to figure out damage out? You'll probably flip back and see what a club does.
Yeah.
Now, that's a real simple example. But now extrapolate this out to some guy trying to chop down the support strut of a water tower.
Right.
And now, at this, you know, I think in the same way, you'd say, well, we know he's got this kind of weapon. We know he's got this kind of strength.
Oh, and add more. You're fighting robots. And he's wanting to know if he shorted any of them out.
Yeah. And you have to take the rules you have in place as some kind of a starting point. Go ahead and back that out and look at two other things. One is some degree of realism. But the other is, what kind of story are you trying to tell, and what kinds of results do the players want in order to keep themselves feeling like they are playing their character in the way they want to? And then out of this, build some kind of fair result. You know, I might say, okay, Wayne, we're going to roll your strength. You've got an axe. You can chop through it. We're going to roll your strength. If you roll really well, you've chopped through it. If not, it may take you a couple rounds. I mean, you'll get there eventually. It's an axe on wood. Once it falls down, we might give the robot some kind of a roll to jump out of the way. And if they don't, or botch it up real bad, maybe each one gets a different roll. And we'll just say, you know, if I roll above this, they're fine. If I roll below that number, they're partially malfunctioned. If I roll a one, they're completely shorted out and shut down. I mean, just make something up based on whatever rules you have present, just to keep it going.
And see, in this situation, I'm just simply going to disbelieve, because I'm playing in a fantasy campaign. All of a sudden, there are robots. Yeah, I don't think so.
Earthshaker.
Shadowrun, sir. Shadowrun.
World of Warcraft has robot animals that you can ride. It's fantasy. There's robots. Just saying.
They're animatronic.
There's clockwork robots in D&D as well. Not many of them, but
yeah, there are some.
There are clock. I'm not aware of any electronic robots, but there are clockwork robots. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all right, let's move on to our main topic for today. And this was a topic that was emailed to us by a listener, and he did not send a pronunciation for his name. So I'm just going to make one up.
Bob.
Hold on. Just go to Wikipedia. We'll find one.
After last episode, he's just going to make up a pronunciation.
His name is Josheva. That's how I'm going to pronounce this. J-O-S-H-E-V-A. Could be Joshua or Josheva. Well, that's what I'm basing it off. So I'm going with Josheva based on Flavius Josephus. That's just the first thing that came to mind when I saw his name.
So Joe, thanks for the suggestion. Now we're going to butcher your name for the rest of the episode.
Yeah, so
Hank Williams Jr. is going to come out here and sing a sec.
If that's not correct, because he sent us a couple really good ideas, and we're probably going to work through these over some period of time. So if in future episodes you want your name pronounced right, then you can send me a pronunciation guide. But in the meantime, you are Josheva. So, Josheva, the question that he asked, and he both raised some potential solutions we're going to kick around, and we came up with some solutions of our own that we're also going to kick around. But the basic issue he brought up is handling travel. In most role-playing game situations, you're going to have some point in the plot where the characters have to travel from point A to point B, and we are talking about a significant amount of travel time. Now, we won't talk about this in terms of distance specifically, because if you're talking about a science fiction game, what in a fantasy game may take 3 days to do may take them a matter of minutes. So we're talking about you're traveling, you're undertaking a journey that is going to take a significant amount of time. Now, the question is, what do you do with this? Because if you just say, well, you arrived, you may have cheated yourself out of the opportunity to describe a lot of setting. You've made the passage of what may be an enormous amount of time completely trivial and unwritten. But on the flip side, if you really drill down to all these pedantic, pointless details along the way, you run the risk that your game is going to turn into a Tolkien book, except not nearly as well executed. And this is going to quickly become boring as hell.
I don't think there's any may about it, personally. I think that you are absolutely 100% doing all of those things. You're definitely cheating yourself out of those good opportunities.
So in my mind, I think there are four basic things that you want to accomplish, or probably want to accomplish, during long periods of travel. Number one is to give the players a sense of the time that has passed. If they're walking down the road, or taking a starship, or driving a car for a week or 2 weeks, you want them to have some sense that time passed, they were able to take actions. There's some sort of description of what happened during this time. Now, depending on the game and depending on your plot, that could be a short description. This could be a long, involved description. This could be a plot unto itself. But I think that you need to do something to simulate or mark the passage of that time. Point two is obviously you want to keep it interesting. You don't want to bore your players. I don't think that's one I really need to explain. The third point, and this kind of ties back to the first point, is you want to make the travel feel real. Now, that's both in terms of time passed, but also distance and location change. And we will come back and develop that idea quite a bit in a moment. And the fourth is to avoid making it unnecessarily burdensome. And this is also an idea we'll come back and deal with. You want to simulate that passage of time. You want to keep it interesting. You want to do all these things without making them have to roll for taking a dump. All right, there comes a point where this just becomes overly burdensome.
And the solution to all of these, obviously, is to have one and only one random encounter. You have that. It clearly simulates the passage of time. It keeps things interesting. And then they can go on to the new location.
That was
It blends the initial starting point and the ending starting point, as long as you make the right random encounter. For example, if you're moving from a forest to a swamp, you might be attacked by a wolf alligator.
What's this might be grit business?
Yeah. Well, you there are other things that might attack you.
That's why it's a random encounter.
Because it could be a wolf alligator.
It could be an alligator wolf, which is
it's D4.
That's true.
Wolf alligators.
Yeah. You know, as much as we bash random encounters, if you're traveling a road that is supposed to be dangerous, how do you show that to your players if you don't do something like
that? That wouldn't be a random encounter, though. That should be a scheduled encounter for that very reason. It's like you're traveling down the very dangerous traitor's road, and, you know, sure enough, here's why you find why it's dangerous.
Yeah, but a whole...
No, to give you an idea about our current campaign, Chris, the land is difficult to travel in because there are spiders and other things out there. I don't want to roll the combat against the spiders. I don't want the random encounter against the spiders. But we're not getting that in our game right now at all. We're not seeing this danger. How do you get that danger to your players if you don't do a random encounter while traveling?
But that's my point. It shouldn't be a random encounter. You can't have a campaign where you say this road is dangerous for these reasons, geographically, banditry, whatever you want to say. You can't say that it's dangerous without backing it up with not a random encounter. It should be a scheduled encounter when you're traveling on that road.
Yeah, I see what Chris is saying, and I generally agree with them that you can, as a game master, just have a note in your margin that says, okay, if they travel this road and we're doing pretty well on time, that the game's not slowed down or boring, because, you know, if you're already pressed for time, maybe you don't want to slow the game down with a fight. But you have a little note in your margin that says, look, they're going to get waylaid just by a handful of bandits. Here's some stats for them. It's not a truly random encounter, because right. It's not like I roll a d20 on a 1 through 5, they get jumped. If they get jumped, I flip over to the woodland table, roll a d20. Oh, I rolled a 3. They get attacked by roll a die. 1d3 wyverns. And it saves you that sort of...
I actually have no problem with random encounters.
I don't either. And I think in the case that you're describing, not a total random encounter where your creature encounter is random, but this example of the bandits on the road, well, let's say that there's a 20% chance that when they're traveling on this road, that they'll be attacked by bandits. Mm-hmm. There's your random number. Well, you roll percentile dice. If they get 20% or lower, boom, you've got a random encounter of bandits.
Here's the real difference, I think, between a truly random encounter and a pre-planned incidental encounter. And it's actually the word I just used in there, which is pre-planned. This road's dangerous, and I want to have you guys get jumped by bandits. And these bandits are not part of the major plot. They're just an illustration point that this road is dangerous. I have the time not just to stat them out and save myself a little bit of page flipping in the monster manual, but I can give them little bits of personality. I can give them quirks. I can have them set up a clever trap. I can have complexity to the encounter, where if I'm just rolling it on a random chart and come up with some possibility of a monster, and I don't even know what monster it's going to be. I mean, a truly random encounter, none of that depth will be in there. You're simply getting attacked by three wyverns because that's what the D20 said. You didn't
make the chart.
Okay, now that is a fair point. That is a fair point.
But I think that does come back, though, to the pre-planned. I get your point. It's pre-planned.
I mean, if you
made the chart, then it's
don't
more
necessarily
pre-planned.
Just get yeah, a blanket.
I think you could take this, though, in a different direction. And yeah, you may roll those random things for the thing. And rather than turning into a dice rolling exercise, why not turn that into an RP exercise and have that encounter essentially be something that they happen upon that was a random encounter maybe for somebody else? So they come across the scene of the battle after the fact, and then how they deal with dead innocents or the dead bandits or the wounded merchant suddenly now becomes an RP issue where you're still conveying the dangerousness in this particular case, and or you're giving the characters opportunities to decide how they want to treat and deal with some of the stuff. So now you start learning a little bit more about these characters. Does this guy believe in burying the dead? Does this guy believe in burning the dead? How are they going to go? They want to just leave them alone. What are they going to do? You know, you have opportunities to create some situations where you can see how the players are going to react and have their characters react to this situation.
Well, yeah, Chris, you're dealing with the term random encounter in a way too narrow version. You're thinking, I have my DNG, I'm rolling a D20. That's not necessarily the end-all and be-all of a random encounter. You can have a card box full of 3x5 index cards that is labeled forest. You could have a box that's labeled the forest of Blarney Flew or whatever, especially if this is an ongoing campaign where they're traveling through the forest of Blarney Flew on a regular basis. You can, at whatever point, flip open the box, whip out a card, and it might say on it, came across dead bandit camp.
That's the key word too. Regular mm-hmm. basis. And that's what I'm kind of thing I'm talking about. You're traveling a lot. You're on these roads that are dangerous. This needs to be shown somehow. Well, I don't want to have a counter after counter encounter every time.
I like Johan's solution because of the fact that his 3x5 cards would allow you to give depth and meaning to these encounters. Because that is my real problem with a random encounter, is they lack context and purpose.
Right.
You're getting attacked simply for the gratuitous sake of getting attacked by something. And other operative word here is something. It just doesn't matter what. A gelatinous cube bursts forth from the earth to attack you just because it can. Whereas what you're describing, Johan, if you have this sort of a chart you yourself built or these index cards, you can give these things context. And now this is where I think these kinds of, I'm going to stop calling them random and start calling them incidental encounters, become really useful in that while you're traveling, this is a great way to convey setting. Because if you're traveling from A to B, and part of the description of A to B is there's a weird kind of monster that lurks these roads. It's a dangerous place full of motorcycle bandits. Whatever it is you're trying to convey, it doesn't even have to be a combat encounter. You're going through a place that's full of a lot of poverty, and you might run into a beggar who has some particular angle or some particular personality. All this stuff can be pre-written out, and it is a great way to show people setting, because you know what? Not everything in a setting has to be tied to some great big overarching plot. They can be.
It's, absolutely.
And that's my point, is that there are specific things that you do indeed want to convey in regards to setting, in regards to political backdrop and everything else that you've laid out. Yeah, the use of these incidental encounters, which really, I guess, in the way I would look at them, these would be scheduled encounters. There'd be absolutely nothing random about it. This would be something that isn't always necessarily plot specific, but it is setting specific in the sense that you want to give more than the box text you gave when you started out this campaign. And so this is stuff that should be, jotted down and notes made about it. So that as you go through, A, you're showing the passage of time. B, you're covering that distance from A to B, and you're giving opportunities for other things to happen rather than going from, okay, here's this set encounter. Now here's this set encounter at point B. You get to do this stuff in between, and it makes things feel a lot a lot more organic.
The next point that he brought up in his email was simulating daily life or describing daily life. Let's go back to a fantasy game. You make them describe the process of setting up the camp, of posting the watches, of preparing the evening dinner, to describe what their daily routine is like. And I think that's useful to a point. It's useful in that it helps them think about the daily lives of their character. It helps them think about what it is like to live in this sort of setting. And the game master can do a little bit of pushback of, you know, you can say after 3 straight days of eating nothing but the fish that somebody got out of the river that runs through the Blarney Flue Forest, you guys are getting a little tired of fish. And it's not even there's no rules against anything. It's just a role playing thing. You just put it out there as a piece of setting. But if you push this too far, it becomes very repetitive. You're on a 2-week trip and you're going to make them describe their daily routine 14 times over.
You make them describe it once.
Yeah.
And then you're done.
It gets to be tiresome. I mean, you cannot draw out that RP too much.
Now, there is a very definite exception, which is if they are enjoying the RP of the camp, if they're interacting with each other, if the players are creating their own experience out of it, heck, let them have at it and take a nap.
But that goes beyond their daily routine to RP.
Right.
They have is character interaction. This is character development. That's a whole lot more interesting than figuring out who's cooking dinner, who's taking the first watch, rolling to take a dump.
Right.
I fell into that trap. It definitely did something that you really, really have to be careful for. I was running an urban-based campaign, and I did let this one player, he went through, and he was really enjoying himself. And for the first maybe 2 or 3 times that we did it, it was actually kind of fun because he went through his daily routine where he got up, he went out, he got the food and everything that he wanted for his meal later on. He went back, he was making the meal. And it was actually, he was being very descriptive, and it gave me a chance to really kind of do a lot of setting conveyance in that city and have him meet some interesting NPCs. But the problem that we fell into was that it just really started to bog down, and he got into hogging that spotlight, which we all know really upsets Pat. And he just really started to dominate. And the other players were getting really kind of upset about it and the fact that they weren't getting any chance to do anything, you know. And so you really got to be careful about the usage and the frequency with which you do that kind of stuff.
Now, there are certain circumstances where it is absolutely appropriate to have a detailed minutia of the daily occurrences. The one description I have heard of a campaign in which that was absolutely suited was somebody who was talking about a D&D game he ran, which was a zombie survival game in which the party led a group of 20 civilians up to the roof of a building where they were trying to wait out a zombie horde, basically a zombocalypse, whatever that is they're calling it these days. Zombageddon.
I think it's a band.
Probably is. But in that particular instance, it was very appropriate to know how they were getting food. It was even appropriate in this one instance I have ever heard of to know where they're crapping, because that's going to draw the zombies if you're putting it somewhere they can smell it. And, you know, all of that was essentially the campaign, was their day-to-day life trying to survive on this rooftop for months.
Well, and this ties right into point number 3, which is personal upkeep. And the way he put it is, do you start to measure your travel instead of in miles and field rations, where you make them account for where they're getting their water, where they're getting their food? You make them account for the things that a person consumes on this kind of journey. It could be fuel if it's in a modern science fiction game. And I think it really depends on the type of game you're running and where you're at in the plot. Mm-hmm. For example, in your zombie game you just described, this is relevant and important. You need it to figure out what's going on. I think in the typical game where you're just adventuring from well-stocked town to well-stocked town, it's honestly just a whole lot of paperwork to figure out whether they have enough beef jerky or not. Some counterexamples where I've seen it come up and be very important. When we run post-apocalyptic games, post-nuke games like Skies of Glass, depending on where you're at in the world, food may be very hard to come by. Not having enough food really can be the difference between making a trip and not making a trip. But that's what the game's about. That's an integral part of the setting, is scarcity. Another example.
The notorious example is Dark Sun.
Yes, water and Dark Sun.
I have never had a character in Dark Sun die from anything other than thirst.
Another example would be Battletech. in BattleTech, especially if you're playing prior to 3050.
Yeah, if you're doing 3025 era.
Yeah, if you're doing 3025, material scarcity is a big deal. And so we used to keep really detailed spreadsheets, not of food, because that wasn't scarce, but of parts. How many actuators do we have and what tonnage are they meant for? How much armor do we have? How many missiles do we have in the stock? Because you could get to a point in the game where, depending on the availability of things and what you'd manage to salvage and what you'd manage to buy off the market, you could get there where you've got this great mecha that has no ammunition. Yeah. And that was an intended part of the setting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a part of the game. You had a different game when you took that away. And part of where I lost my love for BattleTech setting is when they did take that away. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the market was so bloated with stuff that mechs felt less like a privilege and more like a tank.
I've done that even in vanilla D&D games for extended dungeon crawls. I've had players, you better track how many arrows you have. You better track how many rations you have, because you might not make it out to town in time. So,
yeah, I think that it's important whenever you're doing that, you've got to establish that up front. Like, oh, you're absolutely. Saying, you're going to play in this, in these campaigns with this situation, then definitely you're saying, okay, there's material scarcity of whatever type. And mm-hmm. so we're going to do that. To me, I was sitting there thinking that this sort of runs along the same lines of encumbrance in my sure. line of thinking. If you're playing in a campaign where you've not got food scarcity and it's going to be fairly easy to find food and your players aren't broke, I like to sort of do, I'll say sort of the simple hand waving of, yeah, we don't need to account for every day's, for right. each meal of the day. And I don't need to, do this encumbrance that much. As long as it's within reason, it's okay. Now, I know that I'm going to get clubbed on the forums yeah. for,
I'll bad mouthing encumbrance.
But to me, it's one of those things where it's part of the minutiae that just bores the hell out of me.
There's encumbrance and there's common sense.
Yeah. But on the same time, I absolutely in favor of what was said in a situation where it is supposed to be scarce, post-apocalyptic or, the dungeon crawl where you're saying that it's going to be like that. Yeah. Keeping track. That's part of the fun of it for me mm-hmm. because I know that that's the way it's going to be. And I know what that's what to expect. So you do it. So there, I think it absolutely is good.
Here's where I'm going to deviate from some of the points that Flavius Josheva wanted us to discuss. One of the ones that I have found is fairly useful in games is personal projects. Character's life in many role-playing games is about like Jack Bauer's, where you just have these really chaotic, hectic,
sure.
brutal periods of time. What travel represents in all probability is a period of time where not a whole lot's going on. And so one of the questions I ask them is say, okay, you don't need to drill this down to the second by second level, but you've got 2 weeks while this starship flies from this system to that system. What are you doing? I mean, that's 2 weeks. Are you reading a book? Are you working on a personal project? Are you in the bay trying to build robots? Are you playing practical jokes on each other? And I think it's great because it forces the players to think about their characters as human beings, to think about them as people with outside interests. And it also allows them to develop their characters in new ways, to explain, okay, when we get that next level or next whatever, that next skill, this is how I got there. Or maybe there's something I'd really like to have or have access to, a tool I want in my toolbox that I just plain haven't had the opportunity to get, but I'm going to use this time to acquire it.
I think that's easier in sci-fi games too, because it makes a lot of sense to me doing that in a space game. If someone comes to me in a game where I'm riding a horse from town to town and asks, what are you doing in your downtime? I don't know that I'd have an answer, because you're having a more active role in your travel.
Well, and that's fair enough. And I realize also on horseback, it gets a little harder to do certain things. But, we have to appreciate the fact that there were times people existed that way, and they did not always just sit their hands folded and bored on those horses. Whether it's conversation, whether it's writing in a book, I know it's going to be a little bit difficult, but it can be done. Whether it's crafting some kind of object, whether it's even just contemplating something. Wayne, in the case of your bard, maybe you're working on a poem or a song. Maybe if you're a wizard, you're sitting there flipping through your spell book and you're arcane theory books trying to develop a new spell. And I think the GM ought to roll along with that. I mean, as long as it's not game breaking in some way, the GM ought to give you that opportunity to develop yourself a little bit.
And a lot of systems have support for that rules wise as well, to give you the chance to sit down and say, my character needs 4 weeks to do this. And the travel time gives you an opportunity to do that, when normally speaking, a lot of RPG campaigns don't give you time to just sit on your butt and work on your new spell or
mm-hmm. yeah,
whatever it is that you're going to be doing. That,
yeah,
that's right.
True. Yeah.
The next thing I thought about is that travel is one of the best opportunities a GM has to draw out setting. Think about a road trip modern day. You're driving from one city to another. What's the main thing you're doing? Looking at setting. You're looking around you. You're noticing the things that go by. If you take a long car ride, you may notice the difference from you start out in the grasslands, you drive through the forest, head through the mountains, and end up in the desert. Like I actually just described a trip from St. Louis to Albuquerque I took at one point. And as a game master, you ought to be taking advantage of that. Town A sits in a certain place, or System A sits in a certain place, or City A, or whatever it is in your setting, sits in a certain place. Destination B sits in a different place. Use this opportunity to draw out the differences between the two places and to draw out the things that occur along the way. That could be just a transition from wetlands to the desert.
Wolf alligators.
Or that could also be maybe there's equally interesting things that occur along the way.
I would also add to that, too, and when you look at certain fantasy movies, like, for example, the other day, I happened to be watching parts of Conan the Destroyer, and they do a lot of just simple travel, and what they do is they show all of this crazy terrain that Conan and all of his traveling companions go through to go there. They don't bother getting into the little towns and things they would have stopped along the way, of course, because they couldn't, because it's a two-hour movie, but clearly, when you have such massive geographical shifts, they're bound to run into some interesting cultures, and here's a perfect opportunity to do that.
We'll go back to an example I used earlier, which is Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. There's an observation I made, and I think I've made this on the show, but if not, I'll just go ahead and make it again now, which is that if you look at most books, they're either plot-driven or character-driven. Tolkien wrote a very interesting story that, in my opinion at least, his story is primarily setting-driven. It's about the places and the history more than necessarily the people and the events that are occurring there. And I say that based on the number of pages he dedicates to each. He spends far more time talking about the places they're going than he does talking about the things they do upon arrival. Now, I think, as a game master, you can go to a wrong extreme where you spend too much time in exposition. But I think there is nothing wrong with saying, you guys are passing through the Haunted Hills, and you pause to describe the Haunted Hills a little bit, and you tell them a neat little legend about the place. And once again, don't spend 30 minutes on exposition, because you just bore the crap out of your players. But it is a wonderful way to trickle out setting description that you may not have other easy ways of conveying. And take advantage of that. If they're traveling somewhere interesting, draw their attention to that.
It depends a lot, I think, on the scope of the game that you're running. If you're running a game that's only going to run for three sessions and then you're scrapping that campaign world, who cares about the Haunted Hills? No one.
Right.
If you're running a game that you're expecting to run for 4 years, no, you don't.
Okay.
You're wrong. If it's going to run for 4 years, though.
That was nodding. Then, you guys can hear that over the mics and all.
I raised my hand.
Oh, you raised your hand. Yeah. I'm sorry.
But, you know, if the campaign is expected to run for 4 years, then they might very well want to know about the Haunted Hills.
See,
they might need to know about the Haunted Hills because they might want to lead the orc army that's going to show up 6 months from now onto the pass that goes through the Haunted Hills so that the ghosts kill them all.
And this also brings up another possibility, which is side quests. I'm differentiating these side quests from the encounters we gave before, and that these may very well be player initiated. An encounter comes to you. But in the case of a side quest, you simply tell them you're passing by the abandoned temple of Zul. You can go in there if you want. And if you do, I've got a couple notes on what's in there, or you guys can keep going. You're in the Haunted Hills, you know, and you tell them the legend of the Haunted Hills. Well, all of a sudden, they're pretty fascinated by that, and they decide to go look into it. Mm-hmm. You as a game master might have something in the margins that says, okay, if they decide to look into it, here's a little plug and play of what might occur out there. And this probably has nothing to do with your main plot. But nonetheless, it's something that allows them to distract themselves. And the great thing about this is that if you pause on these side quests, if you stop out there, it helps build a sense of time. And the reason being, if this journey, let's say, took 2 weeks to do, you have to create a sense with the players outside of the game that some amount of time has passed. If you spend an hour on a diversion wandering through the Temple of Zul and reading all the old books and figuring out what occurred there or fighting the monsters.
Looking for Dana.
Yeah, looking for Dana, looking for the gatekeeper and the keymaster or whatever's in there. Then that helps with the players. They now have the sense, wow, we kind of got off subject a little bit. Yeah, we were traveling. And it creates sort of a chapter break in their minds between origin A and destination B.
You know, if you're a Chad-like GM too, when that situation happens, if the players really got into it and they really loved it, there's nothing that prevents you from making that part of your plot somehow. Chad's already said he's done that for us in a few cases. Things that were meant to be a side quest, we jumped on it. Now it's part of the plot.
And along those lines is a great way to gauge character interest. If you don't know if they're interested in something or not, while they're out traveling, dangle a little side quest or an incidental encounter that's along those lines. You don't know if they're interested in the Haunted Hills? Okay, have them pass through the Haunted Hills and see what they do. Have some guy come running down the road and who's fleeing the Haunted Hills. See if they care. It's a great way to find out what motivates them.
It also does a good job of breaking out of the mold of the single track plot, which is very easy to fall into as a GM. I know my players have definitely called me on it, though not necessarily obviously from time to time. When any NPC mentions a specific place name, instantly, that's obviously where we're supposed to go.
It's underlined quest text.
Right.
I was sitting there thinking the exact same thing, and in your examples you're giving, especially like somebody comes fleeing from the Haunted Hills, one of the things that I've always struggled with is getting beyond the thought that, yeah, that this is part of the main plot that he wants us to do, not that it's a potential side quest. I mean, I know of side quests from more from video games and MMOs or whatever like that, but when you, like in the role-playing sense, it's oftentimes, it's sort of what you said, Yuan, it's you have that one-track mind of, since you don't build in a lot of potential side quests or player-initiated quests, you can fall into that trap or that rut of thinking anything I encounter is what we're supposed to do.
Right.
It makes it's you feel like you're being railroaded when you're not.
Right, sometimes. Exactly. When it's that's not the case. And so, or my challenge to the GM there is that if you're going to do this, you need to either talk about that up front or do it consistently so that your players know, yeah, there's going to be things that'll come up that really are side things that we can look into if we want, if we have time or not, that it's, you know, so that you, well, you know what I mean? Time, so that you sort of know.
I agree with the consistency. I disagree with the letting them know ahead of time, unless it's at the beginning of the campaign.
That's what I meant. I mean, right. I just mean, yeah, don't tell them, oh, okay, guys, side quests coming up. I mean, it's, you know, that you initiate that, because like I said, I'm always in that mindset of anything that the GM throws in front of me, this is obviously what I'm supposed to go do. And maybe that's not what you had in mind.
I think it's relationship building, in that I've noticed that over time, players and GMs usually feel each other out on that. They usually kind of start to get some kind of cue as to whether something's critical to the plot or just an opportunity. But I do see what you're saying, though, that in a group that maybe hasn't built that kind of rapport, it may be a little too easy to get tangented on something that really wasn't all that important to begin with. Mm-hmm. Which is why you may be better off not throwing it in their faces, but just mentioning it in the background.
Yeah.
And if they want to pursue it, they'll ask you about it. If they don't, they won't mention it again. You don't have a guy come running screaming down the road, maybe, but once again, you just mention where they are.
Yeah, you just put it in the 60-page setting document that you give them all.
Which they all the
campaigns. You're right.
Yeah,
right.
Every player totally reads those.
I think you're right, though, Dan. I think it's a subtlety issue where, like you're saying, don't just make it like smacking them in the face with it, but you know, you sort of have it in the description. There's a plot hook there, potentially there, maybe, but it's not just a blatant in your face. Bam. Here you go. Guy screaming out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
The last point I'm going to bring up here, and this is something that Joshiva suggested that I think is an outstanding idea that I had not thought of, which is, let's go back to our objectives here for travel. And one of them I mentioned is that you want to create a sense of separation, that place A and place B are different places, and it took time to get from place A to place B. And you're trying to instill that not per se in the characters, but in the minds of the players. You want them to have a sense they've gone somewhere else. In a movie, you might accomplish that by having a montage of places.
Montage.
Well, I mean, if you look at the Lord of the Rings movie,
a montage.
When they're traveling along, you get all these montages of them in various locales around New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're in mountains, they're in grasslands, and you get the sense they've traveled a great distance. And one of the things that he suggested is using a little bit of metagame personal experience to create that separation. When they depart town A to head to town B, you maybe talk a little bit about the journey. You kind of set up, this is the description of the road. Then you stop the game. You take your bathroom break, your snack break. You stop to call the spouse, your smoke break, whatever your group does, but you take your 10, 15, 20 minute break. You just kind of shoot the breeze about how the game's going or things completely unrelated to the game. Then you pick it up again with the second half of the description of the road and their arrival into town B. And what that has done is, in the minds of the players, that has created an artificial chapter break.
Yeah, I really like this idea. I think it's great because it's just like what you said. You know, it really accomplishes what you want to do. And it's nice in the fact that basically you set up the travel and it avoids a lot of these issues that we've talked about throughout this episode of like, well, what are we going to do? It's like, I don't want to just do another random encounter. I don't want to do this. So boom, you take a break and it's the same thing. You go out and you do it like you do your dinner break or whatever.
And something, and then you come
back,
anyway.
You sit back down at the table and boom, travel's done. You're at destination B and you go from there. It's perfect.
I love the idea. If you need to take the break anyway, if it's everyone's going to need a bathroom break, everyone's going to need a food break. However, I would be nervous if you've had heavy role play, everything's going well, and now it's time to travel, and then you're artificially inducing this break just to cause that. We've talked before about how interrupting the flow of a game can be a dangerous thing, and I love this idea if the break needs to happen anyway. Time the break to use to your best advantage. I'm not an experienced GM as you guys, but I would be nervous about trying to artificially include that in.
I can see that it could be bad if you're doing a lot of traveling and you're taking breaks every 10 or 15 minutes or something. But I think if you're going to have in a session, maybe you have one or two travel points.
Right.
I think you're going to be okay, even if it's artificial, and say, all right, guys, we're traveling. Take a 10 minute break here to do whatever. Let's get a snack break. Oh, let's go pop open the zingers or, you know, somebody brought this out of the other and it's fine. I don't think it would be that big of a deal.
Well, and if you've got something where the flow is going really strong, obviously the heart and soul of your game is more important than trying to artificially accomplish something through travel. If traveling from town A to town B is really not the important backbone of your game, then I think at that point you are probably better served. You know, you had great RP going. They hit the road. You say, okay, guys, here's generally what you see along the road. This is what the travel looks like. You depart the town. When you leave, you're surrounded by trees and woods. And that eventually turns into these plains of dead yellow grass, which leads into town B. Is anyone doing anything worthy of note on the trip? No, no, no. Okay, great. You guys have arrived in town B. You describe the town gates and you go from there.
You know, furthermore, I think if you're in a situation where your travel point is going to be before a major plot point or a major part in the story, I think it would be great to take this time, because what you can do during that time is the players around the table, while they're sitting up there, you know, noshing on whatever they're eating, they can discuss what's been going on, sort of continue the role playing. Mm-hmm. Not at the table. They can talk to each other about, okay, what's been going on, or what do we think's coming up, or, you know, talk about strategy or this, that, and the other. So it's not like it's a complete break from role playing. It's not like you're going, whoa, okay, I'm not doing anything about role playing anymore. I'm totally forgetting about it. It can be a little bit different. So you just take it away from the table and, you know,
it's kind of like a slow
involved.
Dissolve is really what you're describing. Is you're cross dissolving long between two different scenes with that kind of thing, which I totally agree with.
The ideal solution to this problem, obviously, is to simply handle all traveling in real time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If they're going to travel someplace 2 weeks, stop the game and reconvene in 2 weeks.
Exactly.
I think that's awesome.
And if they're going to be attacked on day 8, well, they'd better be there to play.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
That or you show up on their front door with a knife.
That's right.
Well, especially when that encounter occurs on second watch in the middle of the night, you better come pounding on that guy's door.
Yeah. And I will also say this. I think of all the things we've talked about, my advice would be to mix it up with all of these. I would say don't just do one thing all the time, like the breaks. Don't do a break every time. You know, look at these three or four things that we've talked about or that are out there, or even some other ones that you might have. Have four or five different ways of passing the time and travel and just vary that up. Well, so you're always, maybe you're doing something a little bit different every time.
There's certainly no one size fit all.
Oh, no.
I mean, well, with the exception of one random encounter.
That's true.
That is one size fits all.
But I mean, you've got to look at the current nature of your group, their interests, where you're at in the plot, what they're trying to get out of this journey, what you as a game master are trying to convey through the journey. And based on Absolutely Pat, you've got to mix and match these ideas to get the right mix. Because I mean, I've had gaming groups where we spent entire sittings dealing with a trip.
Yeah.
I've had gaming groups where it's just three sentences and move on. Mm-hmm. It was not the point. So definitely mix and match. But I hope there were some useful ideas in here. And I want to thank Joe for sending this email in. And if you guys have questions or comments, don't hesitate to send them to the various mailboxes you can find linked off of feartheboot.com. We love hearing from you guys. We can't. Are you ready to get out of here, Chris? Do you have
just splice that onto the end of the episode?
Hot
it'll
date
be fine.
Somewhere? So
yes,
apparently he does.
For those of you at home, he just hung up on Skype. So
I guess
Julie just came in horny. I'm not.
You know what? I bet that's what it is. She's probably was really flashing outside the door there.
So
you know what we're missing.
and I'm out of here.
He rolled his check to have to poop.
That's true, yeah.
I think Chris had a random encounter he wasn't expecting and had to leave the table. So anyways, for the rest of you guys, yeah. So send us in your comments and questions. We love hearing from you guys. We can't cover everything on the show, but we certainly are always on the lookout for anything interesting you guys have to add to the conversation. And thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.